Yes.
Well, many of the people I've talked with have told me about home medicine and home remedies, and many of those remedies have actually aided science and developed.
The only home remedy that I can ever remember, my folks always in the fall, they always went out and got goldenrod and hung it up. And
whatever for?
I found me. That was for everything, I guess. No, I don't know just what they used it for.
Was it a tea?
You steeped it and had a tea. This goldenrod made a tea. But we had a country doctor, Dr. Shaw, when I was a kid. You probably heard all about him.
Now. Well, I've heard a few things.
He was the greatest.
He had a brown salve that cured everything. Whether it was a cut or a burn or a rash or what, he had this brown salve that. And I swear, it was good.
He lived in the parsonage down in Waitsfield. And he would, in the wintertime, I guess some of the time he had a sleigh, horse and sleigh. But many times, either he didn't want to or for some reason he would walk. And he'd been known to walk into North Faiston for somebody sick. And house calls were $1. Office calls were 50 cents. And you'd go in there, and his shelves would be lined up with these jars.
You got $1 worth of medicine for every 50 cent call.
Of all kinds of medicine, and he would, you want to take it down, and he would taste it, find out what it, try it, and then he would.
Yeah. I remember.
That was my first experience with doctors.
I remember when my father had, apparently it was rheumatic fever, or something of that sort, and I was about 4 years old. And what they did, the remedy, they took burdock seeds and brewed them, made a brew of burdock seeds and mixed it with gin. Now I hope there was more gin than burdock seed,
but
that was the remedy for whatever he had.
Rheumatic fever
or arthritis or whatever. He got over it, so.
And I understand the brown stuff, the mud, it was called, what did they call it, mud? The thing that Dr. Shaw had was something he mixed himself, nobody knew how to do it.
Yeah.
It had a peculiar smell to it too, didn't
it?
It probably it had something we wouldn't be allowed to use now, mercury or something in it, but it had a strong odor. But his daughter used to have it, even she died 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So she did know.
Apparently knew what it was. She had it. Maybe her granddaughters would know.
I was just thinking, are they still around?
Oh, yes. One of them, her daughter, Anne, works in the Meheran's Market.
Ah.
And Anne
Dumas.
Anne Meheran Dumas. And her nephew owns the market, so.
Well, that was one of the things too, the floods that they had along the Mad River that apparently had, the most devastating one in our lifetime was the 27 flood, but apparently they had some years before that actually took out all the bridges down through, and they would go right back and put them back in. I can remember the 27 flood, but we lived in Irisville and we weren't affected by it at all. But the hurricane of 38, the water was as high, and it
took out the bridge by the mill, didn't it?
Yeah, it took out the one down here in Waitsfield, just before you get into Facetown. But we kids were out running around in it when you shouldn't have been left out of the house. The water came up almost to Route 100 from Bridge Street out that way there, and there was cars down underneath the garage that were full of water. And my brother and I and Charlie Munn, Howard Munn's brother, and Clay Kingsbury walked from where Miramar Ski Lodge is through the covered bridge and up to the Valley Paint Store. It was the grocery store then where we lived, with hip boots on, and the hip boots weren't high enough. Why we weren't swept down? We took hand in hand and walked off. Why we weren't swept down the river that time? Just some of the things that you.
Well, one of the things that Earl Fuller told me was that the river was much higher in the
old, what?
The river was much higher in the old days.
I think the river has changed quite a lot above Waitsfield Village, because the dam above the covered bridge has now washed out. They had a dam built up there, and that diverted the water over a canal to those mills where Miramar is. They run the feed mill and the sawmill. They had to do that in order to get the water to go over there, and then it came back into the Mad River. So there wasn't much unless it came over the dam. They went under the covered bridge. But now that that's washed out, it doesn't back up there as much. It just
No, but
right
we do through. Have a lot of high water in the meadows and things that we shouldn't have if they were allowed to clean out the bars in the river a little bit. You know, you can't touch anything in the river, and actually, I can't believe the flooding helps the fish and river life any more than the taking a little gravel out. But it's kind of filling up, and then it spreads up onto the fields. The recreation field gets periodic flooding. And
we used to provide our own entertainment, too. We had everybody, if you could skate, you helped clean off a spot on the river, and you went skating. And you made your own I can remember playing baseball as a kid with some of the other kids right in front of the Valley Store. And you would sit up there and throw and catch and bat the ball and say, here comes a car. And we'd all step out of the road, and then you'd go back and play for 15 minutes more or before anybody would show up, and then you'd see another one. You don't hardly dare step out on the street now before you get run over.
Well, when we lived in the Little Red House, or when you lived in the Little Red House, you went up the road and picked apples and set your stepladder under the tree right in the road.
Right in front of the Howard Bank there.
And then you left it there and went home to lunch and came back and
the ladder would be there, and if anybody came along, they drove out around. Oh, boy.
Well, before the ski industry, really, it was lumbering and logging, and the mills were
and
the main.
It was mainly farming. I think there was more farmers. Of course, we had the mill, and the farmers brought in logs and that type of thing. And you had a feed mill, but I don't think they employed a few people. But everybody farmed. Most everybody had a farm.
And the sugaring was pretty
big.
Yeah, sugaring. Almost everyone had a sugar
farm. And
place.
Milk and. You didn't get into raising, or I guess some people raised maybe potatoes, but you didn't get to strawberries, and somebody sell peas, and they sell corn, and all of those things, not because everybody had their own. I think that the economy had to be farming.
And it was the smaller type farms.
Oh, yeah, there were, you know, somebody that had a couple cans of milk a day or less.
Somebody that had 8 or 10
yeah,
cows.
Because when we came up here, there were... Oh, there were many, many farms, and they went out a little bit. I think the big loss of farmers was when they came out and the creameries demanded bulk tanks. You could no longer ship in 40-quart cans. That weeded out a lot of farmers. And at that point, we stayed in it because we were taking our milk down to Route 100, and the Vassers were. And our creamery said, well, you guys put in a bulk tank and we'll come and get it. Boy, we couldn't do it fast enough just for the fact that we didn't have to take it down to the foot of the hill. And they paid a premium on it, and at that point we did like everybody else. But that weeded out a lot of farmers.
I've heard a number of people have told me they went out of farming.
I think it got to where someone went, even if you had a bulk tank, they got discouraged, or I don't know what the reason was. They weren't putting enough milk in, and they just weren't making it, and they went to doing something else.
Well, it could be, just like we found, that they got older, and they had no help. And you can only go 7 days a week for so long, because you don't have time to be sick. I mean, you go to the barn whether you're sick or not, and you can only do that so many years. As you get older, you can't do it.
I know one of the frustrating things about farming was... they started to come out with things to make life easier. And every year you'd think, boy, now I've got everything. And next year there'd be something else. I remember when they came out with the first hay conditioner. I guess they called it, or hay crusher. It was a machine. When I first saw one, I couldn't imagine what it did, but once you saw it work, you had to have one. It went, after you cut the hay, it came along, somebody else brought it along, and it picked up with these two rolls, like a couple of big ringer rollers, and run the hay through it. They crimped it. Maybe they called it a crimper. And you could almost mow the hay in the morning and put it in the afternoon. Well, obviously you had to have one. But it was a battle to keep ahead of...
technology.
Yeah.
And the other thing too, of course, was the cost.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of farmers, you know, couldn't say no to a salesman. And they had to have the machinery, whether they really needed to have it or not. And I think that put a lot of farmers out of business. They overextended themselves.
I know one of the first tractors we bought was a small Ford tractor. Well, the very first tractor I had was a Farmall that had two plows. You plowed over one way, and then you got up and pulled on this lever and pulled it up out of the ground. You dropped the other one back, and you went the other way. And then the next year, I bought this small Ford tractor that had a two-bottom plow with a hydraulic system that you drive over there, and you pull on the lever like that, and it would pick up out of the ground. Paid something like $700 for that and the plows. And even in 1973, when we went out of farming, I think we paid $5,600 for a tractor alone the next year.
Yeah.
You can pay $45,000 one today and you've got nothing.
Well, and did you ever use horses at all?
No.
Or you, yeah.
No.
We never did. When we moved up here, people say, how many horses? I'm not going to have horses. Well, you can't farm without horses. But we never had horses.
Well, that's scared to death of them, you know.
Yeah.
I like them from a distance, but I know nothing about horses.
No, we never had horses, and we got along all right. And
but the Braggs that were here did farm.
Oh, yeah, they had oxen and horses. Some of these letters, you'll get an education when you read those letters.
Read
And it talks about, we had 100 bushel of apples, or no, 100 bushel of potatoes, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah.
One year they didn't have squash pie because they didn't have any squashes. The squashes, something happened. Either the squashes
frost,
or pumpkins,
early frost.
I can't remember which it was.
I think one of the letters she sent 5 cents for a silver thimble, was it?
Oh, yeah,
something?
That was. Yeah.
Or something. But, you know.
It's been almost 2 years since we read those, and they were.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of forget about what's
Well, now, are the Vassars, have they been here a long time, Father?
They were here before we were. I think their folks came here in 1928, either 28 or 30.
Well, did they come before this house burnt?
I think they had to.
It was right around that time.
They had to, because this house up on the corner here was a deer hunting camp. And the guys that came there came from Virgins and Middlebury and over there, every deer hunting, they would come over here. But apparently the Tunbridge Fair was in September. And some of them came over here and stayed and then went on to Tunbridge. And because one of the fellows was telling us, he remembers when the fire was. He said, we came back from the Tunbridge Fair to stay there, and then they were going back home. And they looked down and they saw this little flame. So they come running down here, and the house had burned that day, and it was just a little of what was left. But I'm sure there were people here when it burned. It was just that they got here after it was all over. But I think the Vassars must have come about the same time that it did, because Robert, the
older
boy of these two here, of the farm boys, was born over here in 32. I guess he was the first one to be born over here after they came.
Did they come from Canada? Vassar?
They came from Winooski.
Winooski or Westford or somewhere.
Because they sound, it must be a French name, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's a French family. Yeah. The younger generation don't speak French, but the parents did. And
are they still alive? Or
no. No, both the parents are gone, and but they've been here a long time.
Were you involved in logging at all?
I was involved in logging to a big extent when I worked for Carl. After he sold the store, that was one of the things. He always bought these timber lots and things like that and logged them off. And this was the beginning of chainsaws. One of the first chainsaws came out. He bought one of the big, heavy, 87-pound chainsaw, a small chainsaw that had a couple of bicycle handles here with a motor, and there was a two-man outfit and another guy out on the other end that held up the other end. And that's what I did for a while, was run a chainsaw, and was involved in logging to that extent. And then they began to get a little smaller and a little smaller, and then they got to where it was a one-man operation. And it was during that time that he had a logging lot over on Palmer Hill, over in Waitsfield Common, that we were working on. And he gave me a section of, he says, you can cut out the lumber here and you can have that to build a house. And I was working 6 days a week for him, and my dad and I took the chainsaw and worked every Sunday for I don't know how long, to cut enough lumber to build a house here. So I was involved, I've more or less been involved in operating the machinery, not in doing it for a business or anything like that. I guess we did have sold a little off from here, but as you can see, the wood pile out there.
I was impressed with that, very impressed with that. I thought, you know, I looked at it and thought, gosh, I should have my camera
It's a very photographed barn, and painters come up, sketchers, and sit up in the road. And
yeah, we're always picking up a magazine.
It was on Vermont.
2 years ago, 89 and 90, the December month of December, and a snowstorm was the barn.
Yeah. But and, it's.
Last year's farm show, it was on the front of their farm show issue.
Mm-hmm, I guess so.
Now, when was this barn built?
1909. That was.
And is that in the letters? Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, no, it's in the letters, but it's not in the.
That's
1899.
Yeah.
Actually, Frank, my great uncle, my grandfather's brother, Frank, stayed here after my grandfather left, with Azro and Annie, and did the farm. And he is the one that decided to build the big barn, tear down the other, build a big barn. But before it was completed, he died. He had a heart attack and died.
And it describes his death in those letters. It tells about he had an attack, and the doctor came and said it was pleurisy. If it didn't...
Give him camphor. He had camphor. Give him more camphor if it...
If it didn't go into his lungs or something, but it was obviously a coronary from the way they describe it. But
I think after that, after he died, Azro and Annie kind of went downhill. That was 1909, and Annie died in 1915, and Azro didn't die until 1920.
And were they were your uncles?
No, my great-grandfather, Azro and Annie. Great-grandfather and great-grandmother.
Oh, okay.
Azro and Annie.
And they had, the kids was Frank and my grandfather, Will.
And Harriet, a daughter. She married an Ainsworth. And Emily. And then Emily died, and her daughter was brought up by Grandma Bride.
Yeah.
And Harriet married an Ainsworth and went to California. So some of these letters, I'm sure, were sent on by the Griggses to her in California.
I took the... out of the originals that Laurie Jensen brought, the letter that she wrote to Missouri about the 50th anniversary, and actually photocopied the letter. So I've got the handwriting and the envelope for that 50th one.
Oh, that's
I kind of wanted to have that much of it. It wouldn't have paid to try to...
No, it makes a whole lot more sense.
It's easy. And she's she's done a good job of transcribing them.
Mm. Well, the other question I had about logging was the Ward Mill in Moortown seemed to drive much of the logging in this area.
Yeah.
Did it not?
Apparently, they were people that bought tracts of land, and the older Wards, they ran a grocery store in Moortown to for the mill workers and for people there. And one of the things they tell about, I'm sure they did, that they would maybe somebody would have a a store bill, a grocery bill, and they would take this track of lumber or that one. So they did a lot of lumbering themselves as well as buy logs from anybody that needed the money, you know, and wanted to take them down there. They had quite an operation there. I can remember when they had both the mills going. Mm-hmm. And,
when was that? In the 30s?
No, it was after that, because I used to draw sawdust from both those mills when we were farms. It was after...
In the 55,
yeah, and then they moved one of them to Waterbury. And then they had a kind of a
clapboard mill left.
Well, they had the chair stock mill, where they made these little squares of hardwood, the upper mill. Uh-huh, and then they still have the clapboard mill right at the...
The upper mill burned, and I can't remember whether it was around the 1960...
But they certainly were important to the valley, the lumber business that they developed and helped with landowners and farmers and anyone that had whatever.
Have you seen a copy of the archaeology book? I've got one, but it's been loaned out. Well, I think it's a state publication, but it describes all of the mills that were in the valley and where they were located, in Warren, Faiston, Waitsfield, interesting sites. But I loaned that out a couple weeks ago.
Well, when it comes back, maybe.
When it comes back, perhaps I can at least tell you what it is and where you can get a copy of it.
Yeah, one thing I have, which you might like to see, is a poem. It made up, actually, it's by George Greenslitz of the Parker Slayton
Mill.
I just talked with, Ruth Greenslitz has some more of his poems, but I thought it would be interesting to try and get them explicated. Yeah. And, all the material that you can get like this.
I suppose when the inhabitants first came here, that was the only source of power was the water. They didn't have electricity and steam mills and gasoline engines and that type of thing. They harnessed the power, and then the next guy down, he'd have a mill, and then the next one, and that's the way they did that.
Yeah. And this would have been, I think, the father of the Parker that worked with Emma Ford's husband.
Was it Harold Parker that worked with Emma Ford's husband?
It was who?
Harold.
No.
He was from Hancock. I don't know.
Harold Parker ran a mill up there. Mm-hmm. He was one of the mill owners. I guess Lyle Ford, well, Emma Ford's husband, was part owner at one time. It would be their father.
But Rupert Blair had a photograph of this mill, and I think some of the people. It would be nice to get
We haven't said too much about our historical society. As a result of that, we decided that we should be doing something in Faiston because everybody else was.
Loree Jensen, by bringing these letters to us, really stirred us up, and we thought we should
preserve. So we formed this historical society, and we've had it for 2 years now, going into our third year.
Starting in our third year.
And about the only thing we've been able to do is get a few pictures.
Well, more than that, we have a letter and envelope with the Faiston postmark from the Faiston post office, which
North
was
North Faiston. It's a stamp on it.
In 1903, was it, or?
1905.
It was only in existence for 3 or 4 years over there, and this type of thing, and as I say, old photos and...
Well, you're certainly welcome to copies of these tapes, if you'd like.
This what?
You're certainly welcome to copies of these tapes, if you'd like.
That would be great.
Oh, that would be great for we had a state bicentennial celebration the 21st of September last year. We organized a bus tour of various points of interest in town. Had children's old-time games, had an ice cream social, had a box lunch at noon, and just a general good time. And this lady was here from Utah and did a home video of pretty much of everything. So we have a videotape of what went on, and that will be over there. But it's hard to... I'd like to see some of the genealogies worked up, but that's a pretty time-consuming job.
Well, and talking with Ed Irish, the genealogies are fascinating because he's related to all the Longs. And then I talked with Earl Long in Hancock, who played at a lot of the kitchen junkets.
Mm-hmm. You've talked to them?
Yeah.
Have you really? Mm-hmm.
And Gove, I guess.
Yeah, Bob Gove. Yeah.
Knows a lot of the songs that Earl does, and I want to talk with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked with Otis Wallace, who told me that each team that would go from the Ward Mill had a bell, and you could distinguish
the teams
by the tone of the bell, and he used to hear it in the morning as he was waking up.
This must be fairly interesting.
Oh, I've had a better education in
North somewhere, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
We got
into it because we wanted to find out. We had some pictures of their raising his barn, and it was like in the 40s, and we wondered what happened. We knew it burned, but we wondered if he knew, and he told us exactly how it happened. That he had apparently. They didn't have electricity, and they milked with a gasoline engine that they ran the milking machine, the compressor, or a vacuum. And he had filled the thing with gasoline, and apparently spilled some, and started it up again. And before he could do anything, whoosh, it was, and it. But that's how we got talking with Ernest.
Now, would he be good for me to talk with?
Do you think Ernest would have?
You'd have to.
He's one of these that. Don't say much unless you drag it out of him, you know.
Early and I went to talk to him because we were old enough so he would talk to us. But we knew a little bit what he was talking about.
Yeah, which makes it a whole lot easier.
Yeah, I don't know.
It depends.
How old a man is he?
He's probably 90.
80-something?
Close to 90, I think.
Yeah. He lives with Paul Hartson down in...
Now, he's been somebody else that has been suggested to
Paul?
Me to go see.
Paul,
Paul so maybe if I got them together.
Yeah. That would be great. I'm sure that...
Kit Hartson is Paul's mother.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And she's somebody else I've talked with.
Well, you're going to talk with her tomorrow, aren't you?
Kit?
Or next week?
I called Kit... to ask her about a photograph and asked if I could come see her at some later date.
Mm-hmm.
So, equals Paul's mother.
Are you reaching into Moortown too? Yeah. Have you talked with anyone down there?
No, Greg Sharrow, who also works with me, has been working down there. He's interviewed Mrs. Moore. Aileen Ward, and he's done a couple of interviews down there.
Well, then he would know who to talk to down there.
But I mean, I'm open to any suggestions.
Yeah.
We're sorry we didn't talk more with Emily Eaton, but
her mind was sharp, and she was 103 when she died. And
when
you
she
know,
had her 100th birthday, we said, "Oh, she's nothing wrong with Emily. We'll wait a while," but. We waited a little too long because she lived here in this house. She could have said, you know, the bedrooms were here and here and here, but now we'd like to know the layout of the house. And I don't know why we didn't do that, because we had been up here long enough to be interested in this place.
Yes, but you know, when you are working to survive and educate your kids and keep your family together, you don't really have time. It's as you reach retirement that you can begin
to think
the time.
About those things.
I'm anxious to go out to the new vital statistics building. Have you been in there? They say it's wonderful.
In Montpelier?
Well, the new one in Middlesex, the public records, back of the state troopers.
I've only been in the old one.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about these people, you don't want to wait too long because...
Well, but you think maybe Ernest Nelson with Paul Hartshorne...
I'm sure that with Paul, you probably...
The two of them together would I think...
Now, does Paul work during the day, so...
Paul...
Pretty much. He's
I think he does, yeah. He's fairly busy, but I'm sure that you could probably arrange
he's
a time with
adjustable,
Paul.
I think.
Because he works for himself. You could, and Paul's wife is a daughter of Ernest Nelson, so that's...
Oh, I see.
So that's how the... Ernest has been living with him quite a little while now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good suggestion, I think. Hmm. I think it was Otis Wallace that suggested...
Paul.
Paul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I guess he's...
Next neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was an Arthur Hartshorne.
Arthur Hartson?
Hartson. Who also made up a number of songs. He was married to Belle, who was brought up by Lodge Fuller.
It would be the Hartson that used to live up on Lincoln Mountain Road.
Yeah. And